Okay, good. I just wanted to clarify something as well, is that if you're going to do something like this, it's actually really good also to choose to do something that you want to learn more about, because it's a good way then to open up discussion. So when I actually suggested this as a topic, it's because I'm interested in what other people do. How do people know when it's time to finish or how much is enough? And so, as far as I'm concerned, for what I'm going to do today, it's really, I want you to unmute yourself. I want you to come in and say, well, I do this, I do that, or whatever, so that you can contribute. So it's really, my topic is not about me telling you necessarily what I do, although I'll do that to generate some discussion, but not because I think it's definitive in any way. I think there's many ways of doing this. And in some ways, I think that's what we need to be aware of, that there's many ways of actually tracking how things are going over time. So just sort of in a nutshell, and if I just left that slide up, that's it. What do we need to consider when we're considering whether we've done enough neurofeedback? Well, I think one of the first things is, what's the client's goal? What is it they're trying to achieve? So we're not trying to do everything that we think we can do or see in a QEEG, but we're actually targeting what their goal is. And given that, which would then guide, well, what assessments are needed? So obviously, as a clinical psychologist, there's psychological assessments, psychometrics that might be needed as well. Obviously, there's a client history, you know, to get to the goal. So there's all of those sort of basic skills that we already have. With neurofeedback, symptom checklists are important as well, and I know you all have your favourites. So whatever I'm talking about today is not necessarily what you should be using. It's just something I use. Obviously, with neurofeedback, you're going to be taking some sort of a measurement, either an initial QEEG or a mini map of some sort to guide results, or you know, like a pre and a post type test. And from that, what you'll end up. Sorry, what's that? Someone just unmuted. Was there something? Was there a question? Okay. So from whatever your QEEG is or your mini map is, that'll help you generate hypotheses or protocols, if you like. And the things that are highly likely to want to try first, and then others that may be pertinent. And then in that process, comparing pre and post measures, or even measures in the middle, tracking the changes in symptoms and EEG over time. I'll talk about how many sessions. And how do you know when the client, when enough's enough? Well, sometimes it's because the client says, I'm done. And often there'll be follow-up. A lot of people I see, there'll be a follow-up, might be 3 months, might be 6 months. So just talking about symptom checklists, there's a number of symptom checklists out there. I know John uses the Brownback Mason. He quite likes that one. I don't know if other people use that. You can go on to that website and actually sign up for a number of assessments. One of the ones, I don't use Brownback Mason, although I'm aware of it, and I'm aware of their printout that they give you. I'm sure some of you are using Brownback Mason as well. What's good about Brownback Mason is that the client, it's quite an extensive checklist. So you put in, I think it's about 300 items into the checklist, and what that does, it then puts a percentage score on the likelihood of a particular neuropathology, given that those number of symptoms. So then you'll end up with a map. Actually, I probably have. Let me just go ahead. Yeah, there it is. There's a Brownback Mason. So it gives you a percentage of the neuropathology that might be present there, which can help guide where you might put electrodes and guide your neurofeedback as well. And it's quite a good tracker as well. Let me just go back to the previous one if I can get my mouse. My mouse isn't going to do it. So Okay. The other one I've used for a long time is Peter Van Dusen's symptom checklist, which is quite a nice one. It's actually quite extensive. Let's have a look. So let me see if I can, gone too far. See if I can escape from that. I've used, this is Peter Van Dusen's one from the learning curve. I don't know whether people are familiar with it. There's about 142 different symptoms here, which you rate at a bit of a Likert scale from 1 to 7. So what I like about this is I can send it off by email to the client. They go through and they put in a score. This is one of my clients that did, when did I do this one? Back in 2016. So they put in they rate where they are in terms of those symptoms, you know, not perfectionistic or demands perfection, etc., flexible or stubborn. It's quite comprehensive. It's quite a nice one. So what happens with that assessment is once they've filled that in and you press complete, it then gives you, it pulls them into the different regions of the brain where those symptoms are most likely to occur. What regions of the brain do those symptoms correlate with? And so what's nice about that then is that obviously the red ones there in this person, if I was using this, that would guide me towards some left prefrontal and frontal midline type training. It also shows you the different symptoms which score highly, as you can see there. It's quite a nice one. I quite like that one. I'm sort of reminding myself to go back and keep using it. I don't know if other people have used it and found it to be quite helpful.
Chris, is that spreadsheet?
Sorry, that's Peter Van Dusen's. Okay. Does anyone know? Can you still get it on his website?
No.
Does anyone else use it?
No, I haven't seen it. What's good?
No. Okay. All right. It's quite a good one. As you can see, it's very, very comprehensive. There are about 142 different types of symptoms, which, you know, which are then pulled into this sort of a bit of a brain map sort of idea. Okay. Let's see if I can go back. Why can't I go back to my? I'm trying to go back to my other screen. To my. Here we go. It worked that time. I tend to use Neuralink quite a bit. The reason I use Neuralink as a symptom checklist is I can use it in NeuroGuide. Now, what that does, it's not as comprehensive as Peter Van Dusen's or the Brownback Mason. It's got about 55 symptoms, which the person, let me just see if I can go into full screen. So 55 symptoms, self-rated obviously, and just as an example of one of those, I have tinnitus, noise or ringing in the ears, and then they rate never, really, sometimes, often or always. Now what I can, that then prints off a report of where the person is. So it's a really nice pre-test, mid-test and post-test if you want. I tend to use it pre and post. And then the Neuralink itself can be incorporated into NeuroGuide, so you can actually do your full CAP training dependent on the selection of those symptoms. So for this person, I think this person, the best one we tried was actually the compulsive one. And when we trained the compulsive network for her, so obviously in NeuroGuide, if you're familiar with it, when you train the compulsive network, you can also see the Brodmann areas that have been used in that area. And then you can train, and I'll show you what NeuroGuide looks like when you're actually doing the training and how you can track those changes over time. So that's Neuralink, and I'm sure there's some of you who are already using Neuralink. Now, Brownback Mason and Neuralink, you know, this one's a small charge, but they do charge you per use. I think this one's about $6 or might be. Yeah, I can't remember exactly, but I buy a bunch of them so that it reduces the cost. And I'm not using them each time. I do it pre and post. Okay, I've already talked about Peter Van Dusen. Already talked about that. Okay, so tracking changes. So what do we mean by that? Well, there's obviously within session tracking, you can track changes in progress between sessions. And as I've already mentioned, you can do pre, mid and post comparisons as well. Okay, so one of the things that I give people in between sessions is I give them a symptom checklist. So this person here, I gave her a symptom checklist to this one was just last week. She's someone with a TBI. She came to see me a number of years ago. So I saw her for a comprehensive sort of period of neurofeedback training. Then she came and saw me for some psychotherapy. And then I didn't see her for a while. Now she's come back because of some stress and that in her life. So we're just every now and again. And look, once a month at the moment, I'm only seeing her because she doesn't need the usual training that I would do with someone if they were starting out, like the twice a week, etc. But she, I give her one of these. Again, she can just look at those different sorts of symptoms. And she's very good at going through and ticking or making comments. And then she scans it and sends it back to me the next day with the little comments down here as to how she's going. Now, the other thing that's good about this for myself is that I actually put up here, which then goes into the client notes, what is it I've done? So then it's easy for me to sort of go, okay, well, we did memory issues with this one. I know where the standard deviation for getting the metrics was in NeuroGuide. I know where I started the training or where this particular session we trained at 1.6 standard deviation. And I can also keep track of what the rewards were. So in this last session, we started at 1.6 and this is how she was going. So she went from 149 rewards to 158 pretty quick. So what that said to me was that her brain's cottoned on. It's responding really nicely. She's actually gone up quite a bit without too much effort. And so then I reduced the difficulty. I put it down to getting her into 1.5 standard deviations of the norm. And again, obviously it was harder. But then look how quickly she came up, even at a higher difficulty. And then she came down a little bit, but not too much. And I knew at that stage, last week, she was quite tired. It was actually at the end of her workday. I also give myself some information about the DVD, et cetera, just so that we keep track of that. Yeah. It's for me, it's good information. The client probably doesn't take a lot of notice of that. But, yeah, they certainly do take notice of what their symptoms are. Okay. Let me see what else. All right, I was going to show you another example. Let me see if I can... Do I have it here? Actually, I might just do it this way. I think I have it here. Okay, this is NeuroGuide. So this is within a NeuroGuide session. So, and this wasn't the woman I just talked about, but someone I think just last week. And so what you're seeing with NeuroGuide is that it trains in 5-minute segments with a 30-second rest period. So this is basically looking at the rewards in that 5-minute segment. So the training itself, there's so many, I've selected either the main symptom or selected the Brodmann areas that want to be trained. So, and that'll be guided in terms of whether you're doing symptom training or whether you might do something because the literature says certain Brodmann areas need to be trained or this area of the brain. So, and as you can see back here, if you're familiar with NeuroGuide, that's where the standard deviation has been set. So I can't quite see what it's set at, but it's probably about 1.5 or something, 1.6. I don't know, it might even be a bit higher. But just looking at that in this session for this person, it looks to me as though I could make that just a little bit more difficult for them. But looking at the percent reward up here, it's pretty spot on. So what's nice about NeuroGuide is you're going along and the person gets, you know, like a lot of the systems, the number of rewards or a bit of a counter as to how they're going, which is nice feedback. And sometimes just saying to the person, you know, we're noticing they might be a little bit tired or that there's not much difference there. But just that sort of nice reward or incentive they get just to see if they can do better. So that's NeuroGuide. Does anyone have any questions about that? Or you most of you have probably seen NeuroGuide before, have you? No? Yes?
Okay. No, a lot of people haven't. So anyone who's using NeuroGuide or doing Loretta training, I mean, just hearing about different people's modalities of neurofeedback would be a really interesting clinical interchange. So we'll table that one for a volunteer to consider for November.
Okay. Yep. All right. Now let me just go back in here. Okay. So I've already talked about that person's. For some reason my computer, when I'm clicking on my, I've got share screen here, but it's not going into, there we go. I'm quite sure what it's doing there. I've had trouble with my computer over the last little while, which has been so annoying. It's just doing very strange things. Okay. So this is just another example of the, of using that checklist that I use. Whenever I do a session, the person goes away with one of these. I either email it to them or give it to them. But this one's a lady who I've been doing some one channel training with. So again, this mainly tells me what's been happening. So we did 15 minutes of the C3 to A2, rewarding particular hertz, inhibit one. And I like to know sort of where I've started, and then where it's changed, how it's changed, and that sort of gives me a bit of a guide too as to how quickly the person starts to make those gains or able to do either an enhancement or reward or inhibit. For this lady, it was mainly focusing on inhibiting her theta. So I kept the reward, sort of note to self, I kept the reward not too difficult because I was actually focusing on that inhibition. And then we did some 15 minutes of C4, SMR, and just sort of noticing where it started. And often there'll be, you know, a couple of entries I'll make there depending on where it's got to. And again, here again, just sort of the inhibit one, inhibit two. And just note to self on what I was doing. I just find it useful because then I can keep track of what's going on. So that, in a way, what I've just showed you is sort of my way, and you'd have your own ways of tracking what's happening within a session. So I'm not just hooking someone up and doing something else and not taking notice. As far as I'm concerned, if I can be putting those changes in. When I do hook someone up, I'll often use the automatic threshold to see where they sit, and then I'll put it on the manual. So what I want to be able to do, and you probably have your own ways of doing it, but with one or two channel training, the automatic threshold, where is that sitting in terms of the microvolt? And then I'll put it into manual, and then whenever I change it, I tell them, because I want them to be able to know, well, this is where it's at. They don't have to know the number, they just have to know it's been set, and then then they get a sense, oh, it's becoming easier, and I want them to know it's becoming easier, and then I'll say, well, you know, you're doing really well here, how about we just make that a little bit more difficult, see how you go. So then they know. That's all, so as far as I'm concerned, that's part of the feedback as well. Okay, so I've already sort of talked about tracking between sessions because those checklists that I give people help me do that. And just asking what's improved. So with emotions, behaviours, other things, what hasn't improved, what's actually been made worse. I remember one lady with bipolar disorder who I'd been doing one or two channel training with using Biograph Infinity for on and off for a couple of years, and she did really well with it. She loved it. So every now and again, we'd do a stint of psychotherapy, and then again, we'd go back into biofeedback or neurofeedback because she'd sort of asked for it. And then I got NeuroGuide. I thought, great, use NeuroGuide with her. Hooked her up, did a NeuroGuide session on the Friday. She had a terrible weekend, absolutely shocking weekend. It really discombobulated her. So she sent me a text. I said, see you on Monday, brought it back in, went back to some of the old one-channel or two-channel training, can't remember what we're doing at the time, and she was fine. It just reverted her back. So it's like her brain needed to have the I don't know what it was. I really don't know what it was, but the neuro guide doesn't work for everyone. You know, that full cap with a lot of metrics in it doesn't always work. It certainly didn't for her. It's almost like because I knew her well, we'd found the sweet spots in her training that reinforcing those sweet spots for her actually helped her to stay stable. So that was actually quite a good lesson for me. So sometimes things are made worse, even with one or two channel training. Okay, so with the feedback, like I've just mentioned, when you've got your feedback, what does it say about the brain, or what does it say about your training? Maybe you don't have a sweet spot. Maybe you're not on target, and their brain might be responding very nicely to the neuro feedback, but it's not the right training or the right protocol. And as I've said there, is it too stimulating? Is it too deactivating? So then their decision is to continue with the current protocol or go to the next protocol that might be in your list of hypotheses that could be helpful. And then finally, to review the EEG and reevaluate eventually. So what have I got here? And to ask yourself, has the desired outcome been achieved? So comparing your EEG findings, your pre, mid and post EEG data, obviously symptoms over time, and also what other people say about the client's mood or their behaviour or their cognitive functioning. This fellow, just with that last comment, what do other people say? When he first came to see me, this is 2016, history of neglect, severe neglect actually, as a child. Long history of depression, major depressive disorder as an adult. He's about 61 years old, really struggling with the depression, quite cut off and distant in relationship, but a nice person, wanting to be more connected, wanting that relationship to feel warmer and knowing that there were things he wasn't doing in the relationship for it to be warmer. And a very supportive wife who was sort of also asking, well, you know, what do we do? And she was quite concerned for him. So you obviously I did a cue with him, and he actually had quite a low amplitude and very low voltage type, low energy EEG, which was quite prevalent. This particular one has got quite a bit of alpha coming through there, but okay. So I showed you that previous one because this was his initial, this is his brain map. Now we trained quite a bit with him. The next slide I can actually show you exactly what we did do. And after about six sessions or something of neurofeedback, nothing's happening, he'd say, no, this isn't working. So he kept in, and I'm getting more and more despondent thinking, what else do we do? What was interesting, his wife had a different experience of him. And she every now and again when I spoke to her, because she'd ring me up on occasion, obviously with his permission, and she'd say things like, he's expressing more. When he talks to me, he's looking me in the eyes, more eye contact. So she was noticing things about his interaction that he actually couldn't notice. So one of the striking things I find with him, apart from the very low voltage, is his Z score. In his delta, theta, alpha's not too bad, a bit low at the back. Very low beta, even high beta, and that relative sort of switch off here is one at the back of the head, not here. But the thing that really stood out for me was down here, high phase lag, slow brain. He's an academic, and he was actually really struggling with his work, had a lot of work to do, writing up reports, quite significant reports that needed to be submitted, and really struggling with that. And exhausting himself, putting in the effort to get it done. So to me, this is, you know, this was the initial feedback. It did his EEG, and this did help to guide what protocols we come up with. And this was done after so many sessions. What's this? So the last one was October 16. This is January 17. And now the first thing you might notice is there's just a little bit more energy in it. It's got a similar sort of EEG look. You might initially go, well, that doesn't look much different, but there's just a little bit more energy in it. And he's, it's interesting, his alpha started to speed up just a little bit, which was really fascinating. So doing a map on that particular session after about, you know, just a couple of months, this is after 11 sessions of neurofeedback. So we trained the depression network, and then we had trained the anxiety network. And as you can see, the main thing that stands out, look at the phase lag. It's actually almost normalised. The coherence is almost normalised. It's almost like his brain's starting to, it's starting to function. It's sped up a little bit. It's not quite so slow. And some normalisation across these as well, which was actually really, it was quite nice to see. But he was an enigma, because here he is saying nothing's changing. But I think he's got a lifetime. I wonder whether there's something called a depressive personality. It's almost as if he had learned to be so down on himself and so low, and his thinking is such in such a negative style that it didn't matter what you did, he couldn't see whether things had improved. So if it wasn't from the feedback from his wife, I wouldn't have known that we were actually on the right track. Or if it wasn't for redoing a cue fairly early on after only 11 sessions, that we could do this. Now, the beauty of doing NeuroGuide, if you are using it, is that you've already got your cap on. So initially I always do 10 minutes eyes closed, 10 minutes eyes open. But in this case, I might just do 5 minutes eyes closed, 5 minutes eyes open. But it's a nice way to get an idea. So he in total did about 19 sessions of neurofeedback. He increased his EEG voltage over time, and like I said, his peak alpha frequency came up just a notch or two, which was actually quite nice. But the most important thing, this phase lag persisted, that normalisation of phase lag and coherence, which was quite good. And as you can see, there was a bit of a combination. We used some Loretta neurofeedback. We did some one-channel training. And if we went back to the other one, you'd probably see why I did CZ to T6, and then we did that typical sort of F3, which, you know, that he was the sort of person that had that psychomotor retardated depressive, you know, that typical F3 sort of thing you see. Whereas a lot of people with depression, most of them have dysregulation in the right hemisphere as well, with that sort of they're anxious. You know, a lot of people with depression have the hypercortisolemia and the anxiety that goes with that. He was different. Okay, I don't know if there's any questions about that. So you can see there's a bit of a combination. But just sort of as a way of how I was tracking what was happening with him. Now, another way you might sort of go, well, when's enough, is have a look at the literature. What does it suggest? Rosenfeld has been doing work with depression for a long time. You're probably familiar with his alpha ray symmetry, or he's got a symmetry protocol for depression. And I do know it, but right now I can't. F3 plus F4 divided by, anyway, I'm not going to say it because I don't want to get it wrong, but you're probably familiar with it. It's easy to look up. And a lot of the symmetry type protocols, you've got whatever type of neurofeedback you're using, you'll have an alpha ray symmetry protocol there, I'm sure. Or you can just look at it and work out for yourself what needs to happen. I have found for some people, particularly with that psychomotor retarded type depression, the melancholic type, without the anxiety. Remember one fellow many years ago, very stuck. Talking therapy was not going to work. And this was very early days with neurofeedback. And because of what I knew about depression and what you would likely see, even without doing a cue, because I wasn't doing cues many, many years ago, I was doing mini maps from Peter Van Dusen. I was using two channels, move it across the head and then bring it in into a system where I could look at the whole head, but temporarily it was out. It wasn't all at the same time, but still it was useful. I didn't even do that. I just put on a sensor at F3, trained up some beta, and this fellow went from being so morose to, at the end of about 10-15 minutes, he looked up and smiled at me and he walked out of the room different. It just about bowled me over. But knowing your literature and what you're treating can be really, really helpful. Now, obviously, I backtracked after that with this fella that walked out of the room feeling much better. I did a mini cue and then we did some training and it really helped him. That was a long time ago. It was over 10 years ago. It's interesting. He contacted me just recently. He's now got a good job. He's married, he's got a couple of children, he's living the life that he thought back then he would never live. The literature guided me. So if you know your literature, then you can take a few puns, I guess, punts and see how you go. Okay. So if you look at the literature in terms of how many sessions, I mean, Bayer and Rosenfeld did 27 sessions of neurofeedback. Peterson and Alpha-Asymmetry neurofeedback with 9 subjects just did a maximum of 30 sessions. And in this 2013 study, they just did 8 neurofeedback sessions twice a week, so 20 minutes of actual training with 49 people. And the results still showed an increase in upper alpha power within and across training sessions. And I can't remember how long that sustained, but it actually sustained, I think they tested 6 weeks or something, but don't hold me to that, I can't quite remember. Okay. So talking about the literature, I don't necessarily have to talk about tinnitus, but it's one of those ones that we don't train very much. So if I do get someone with tinnitus, I go back to the literature. What's it actually showing? What's it telling us? Hartman talks about tinnitus as being a disordered excitatory inhibitory balance. So really something, what he's saying is there's something happening in the thalamus that's out of balance. And you'll see that because there'll be an increase in alpha and theta temporally and frontally. So in his study, he just, clients just received 10 sessions of auditory alpha neurofeedback and they did better than the sham or better than the transcranial magnetic stimulation group. So Sedley found that tinnitus suppression correlates with suppression of delta and theta in the auditory cortex. So there, if you know that, then that can guide your neurofeedback protocols as well. And you might use that suppression as a measure over time to see whether what you're doing is actually working. Do you keep going or do you stop? Gospath, 2001, 15 sessions of neurofeedback with rewarding alpha and inhibiting beta in for tinnitus. And Dorman actually did 10 sessions, 30 minutes each over 4 weeks at these particular sites, so F3, F4, FC1 and FC2. So I think if you place a sensor, a spot at CZ to F4, then you get FC2, the bit in the middle. So really what they were trying to enhance the TOR to delta power. In other words, they were trying to bring up the alpha. So the idea with that theory is that you're trying to get that part of the brain to go into an idling and an inhibition to help with the tinnitus. And here's another one here using Loretta source analysis, looking at the generators of delta, theta, alpha and beta power. Increases were localized dominantly to the left auditory area, so Brodmann's area 41, 42, 22. So if you've got NeuroGuide, you might go and just target those Brodmann areas. So another way of sort of targeting what you do. But then if you know what you're doing and why you're doing it, and you can track the changes over time. Here's a nice little app that people can download if they want to track their symptoms. So just something that I thought was interesting. So I picked it out because we don't usually train it. So if we don't usually train it, then look at the literature, use it as a guide. But there's no really right or wrong necessarily with it. I remember one fellow when I was at the hospital many years ago, working at the psychology department there. Again, that was very early days. That would have been back in 98, 99. He did his training. Young guy of about 16. BMX bikes, and he was in competition. He had severe epilepsy. And so he had the potential of being in one of his BMX backflips on his bike and have a seizure. So he came to see me. We did a mini cue. We did some training. I can't remember how many sessions. I might have done up to 30 sessions with him. He actually brought in all these little videos of his training videos of his BMX that he had. So he trained to the videos he'd collected about BMX competitors, which kept him very engaged. And he said to me after, I did a follow-up with him 3 months after, 6 months, and then about, I think it was 18 months after. And I remember he used to say to me, he said, "I do that thing I do in your office and I'm not fitting." So he learnt to feel the awe or that the odd feeling he had just before he'd fit. And then he would do the thing he'd do in my office, which was like almost a feeling or something that he did to make the neurofeedback work. And that really helped him. So I haven't heard from him obviously for many years. I don't know what he's doing now. I think that's it for me. So I'm open to whatever questions you might have. What I've just shown you is something that I do, but it's not necessarily what you have to do. And other people would have different ways of doing things as well, or different ways of measuring. Questions, comments, please, what I've said is not definitive. I want it to be a discussion.
We're all such a coy lot.
We're just overwhelmed.
But we're very, very appreciative. Thank you, Carrie.
Yeah, pleasure. Is this what I just talked about? Is this the sort of thing other people do or use, or, you know, you've got other things which could be helpful for others?
Carrie, can I ask a question?
Yep, who's that?
This is Julie.
Yep.
Hi, Carrie. I use the brown back.
Yep.
I like the brown back, it's good. It has a little maps as well. But I just wondered, because I didn't write down the www.braintrainer for Peter Van Dusen's. Can I have that email link?
Sure, yep. I think it is just www.braintrainer-trainer.com. But if you put in Peter Van Dusen, then it'll come up. I'm not sure, Michelle, are you keeping the...
If you're willing to share the slides with me, I will be distributing them.
Okay.
And making them available through the ANSWER website as well.
Okay. All right then.
Thank you.
All right. Anything else that people want to add, comment?
Yeah, Carrie, it's Jenny. I just want to say thank you. It's a really tricky thing to know when's enough is enough, like how long is a piece of string and what do you use to decide when you change or stop or suspend or increase. So thank you for tackling a really difficult area.
Yeah, okay. No, you know, the reason I said what about this as a topic is because I want to learn more from you guys. I actually don't want to sit here and say this is what you should do. It's not. It's a way of doing it. So that's why I'm open to you letting me know what else you might use or do or, yeah.
I'll throw in then because I use the TOVA a lot.
Okay.
This is a pre and a post.
Yeah. And obviously your population, I don't work with children. I did at the hospital that time, although I wouldn't call 16-year-old a child, but he's not quite an adult either. But, yeah, I work with adults. I give all the children to John. I send them to John.
Carrie, just something else. It's Julie here again.
Yep.
I'm just wondering, like while we're in the learning mode, does anybody else use that principle of stability? Like, so once you've achieved the skill or the change that you want, then do between 5 and 8 more sessions, depending on the person. Does anyone else use that as a method of determining when it's to change then protocol?
I'm sure they do. I mean, I do. If I in terms of operant conditioning, I mean, that's the idea, isn't it? You're giving the brain feedback to learn something new or something a bit different. So you have to train it. But then the important thing with it, you have to overtrain it. And it's the overtraining of it where it seems to stick. And I remember Peter Van Dusen years ago used to say that the changes in the brain happen even after feedback. And he's noticed it's almost like the brain's learned to do something. So it's one thing to learn to hop on a bike and learn how to keep your balance. But when you practice it and you're overtrained, you can pick it up any time.
Consolidated. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Just one final comment, because I did try having a very comprehensive sort of template of mid and sort of training and at the end and using a TOBA and symptom checklist and a couple of other things. But I did a mini map, you know. But yes. I never found the mini map changes correlated with anything. So whatever I was reinforcing or rewarding or inhibiting in the training wasn't showing in the mini map. So I had conversations with Moisha about that, and if I remember rightly, Moisha said, yeah, whatever we're training doesn't necessarily show up in our EEGs.
Yeah, and I would agree with you, Julie. I could have shown you someone else's when I did a pre and post, and in actual fact, midway through, he got worse. And so then we sort of went back to the drawing board. His symptoms were improving, but his brain map got worse, so we just tweaked it a little bit. But I agree with you. And the other thing people often say to me is, how did I go in that session? You know, what's the, you know, and for Biograph, it's unless you've got a counter up there, but even that doesn't mean anything because I'm changing the thresholds. If you take an average of that session, whatever that amplitude or the power in whatever frequency band it is, means nothing. What you want to see is the number of times the person's on target and how well they're able to hit that target. And it's like the brain's on and it's off and it's on and it's off. And it's that flexibility which is more important than an average across a session. So, yeah. You know, but most programs will give you some sort of map of that too, or graph, but it doesn't always mean anything. So, okay.
That's terrific. Thank you, Kerry.
Yeah.
Okay. Alrighty, so that brings today's BCAA clinical interchange to an end, and we are going to switch gears now. For those of you that would like to stay, we're going to have a short meeting of the BCAA executive group, and you're welcome to join us for that. I'll just pop the agenda up, but I will stop recording so that Kerry's session.